even with the laugh. She is 17 years old and thinks that she can walk into some poor community and tell the people who have lived there their entire lives precisely what they are doing wrong and how things should be done instead. I blink at the screen and wonder if she's ever even talked to a real live black person. Since Woodside, and the entire county for that matter, is not exactly known for its diversity. Reggie White, our shortstop, and a dude who fully appreciates the irony of his name, is the only black kid in the whole school. And I know that he's never spoken to Essie. He makes a point of avoiding her, in fact, given some of the shit her father said about African Americans in his sermons, which of course are watched by millions and so inform the national conversation on race more than any small town preacher should. Of course, Pastor Hicks would say that he does not mean the white family when he speaks about how the blacks in our country are inclined toward violence or lust or having babies out of wedlock. "You're not anything like those people," Pastor Hicks once said to Reggie's father. "The worst part," Reggie said from inside the batting cage as he told the story, "is that he meant it as a compliment. That he really believed he was being kind." Remembering this, I frown as Essie goes on about the power of the written word to raise children up out of poverty. And I can see that the lady on the television is eating this whole literacy thing up. I half expect her to start fawning over Essie's qualifications. "You took both AP and IB English Literature? The Chicago public schools are going to be so lucky to have you." Instead, she's saying, "So you might be leaving home before not too long. What do you think will be the hardest thing about that?" Essie looks squarely at the camera, and there is that expression again. The crinkling of her forehead that I noticed in the hall at school today. She says, "Probably. The hardest thing is that I'm pretty sure I'm in love. It will be difficult to let that go." Before I go back outside to take the hot dogs off the grill, I think how Esther Hicks in love is not something I would have seen coming. The next thing I think is that this dude had better run while he still can.
Liberty. When Esther Ann Hicks tells me that she thinks she's in love, it's all I can do not to laugh. Mama never approved of people who broadcast their business all around town, and even though broadcasting other people's business is now literally how I pay my rent, this is one of those moments when I can imagine her eyes rolling all those hundreds of miles away. I'm not sure which is more pathetic, this love-struck teenager act or the bullshit literacy project Essie is peddling. It's a toss-up. They both make me want to cut the feed and get up and walk away. The fact that what is expected of me right now is a sympathetic smile and not a lecture on white privilege or entitlement makes me hate myself even more. I hear myself saying, "This someone's special. Is there any chance you want to tell me his name?" Or her name, I think. But I know that saying something like that would only get me fired. There is a 7-second delay on live television, which is enough time to bleep out expletives or black out the screen in case of wardrobe malfunctions, but not enough to censor any worldview that stands in opposition to the megalomaniac who owns TIL and her sister stations. That's what pink slips are for. Maybe someday I'll be able to pull a stunt like that and get away with it. But as things stand now, I'm not holding any cards. Any outlet that makes a habit of real journalism won't touch me. This job was the only one I could get. Essie blushes and shakes her head. "I don't think I should say." "Well, I can certainly appreciate your desire for privacy, especially given how very public your life has always been." Essie shrugs. It's a practiced move. She says, "I've been very lucky to share my life with so many people, to share the work that our family does both in the church and through our many charities. Well, that's a blessing that is sent to us straight from God. We owe everything we are and everything we do to those who watch and share this journey with us.
Amen,
breathes Mama from just behind my ear.
At least she knows enough to give credit where credit is due.
She is referring, of course, to the Almighty. Whatever differences in opinion Mama and Essie Hicks might have when it comes to definitions of vanity or avarice or sloth, the God they worship is still the same. I actually stop listening while Essie is speaking. I don't have to pay attention to know what she is saying. The line she is feeding me is one that I delivered many times myself. But that was a long time ago. When I see that Essie has finished talking, I shift forward in my seat and ask the only sort of hard-hitting question I am allowed. But as a teenager, as a normal teenage girl, you must sometimes wish you could get away from the cameras even just once in a while and let loose, maybe go a little wild. Essie's upbeat expression fades, and suddenly she looks pale and older than her 17 years. It doesn't do any good to wish for things you'll never have. I blink, uncertain how to follow this departure from the cheerful persona the girl has always put forth in public interviews. I scramble for something to say, but Essie is already talking, laughing. Besides, I'm not sure I know how to go wild. My idea of fun is curling up with a good book. I realize that I have been holding my breath to keep from panicking, and I let the air out of my lungs.
Well, didn't you just beat the devil around the stump?
I hear Mama say. After this, the interview dribbles on and then comes to a rather lackluster end. Essie promotes an upcoming episode of Six for Hicks that follows her brother Maddie and his family on an African safari. She actually hasn't been in any episodes since last fall, while the overseas ministries of Maddie and Daniel have been featured instead. But she promises that folks will be able to see plenty of her as she heads toward graduation and her literacy work next year. Then the lights dim, and the camera is switched off. Candy, the woman who accompanied Essie to the local studio, excuses herself to use the restroom, and I begin to pack up my things. As soon as Candy leaves the room, Essie is standing close beside me.
I need a cell phone, she says urgently.
You can borrow mine. I reach into my bag and begin to fish around.
No, she says. I need one to keep, at least for a while. I need to be able to reach you without using my own phone, in case they check it.
In case who checks it?
My parents, production, any of them. I have a story. If you want it, I need to be able to call you. Hurry, she'll be back any second.
I motion for Margot, my camera woman and assistant, and whisper,
give me your phone.
She looks confused, but hands it over. Essie checks it to make sure the ringer is silenced and drops it into the pocket of her coat. Margot starts to protest, but I raise a hand to quiet her.
Don't call me, I'll call you, Essie says.
It's the sort of phrase that I imagine is used a lot in spy films, but mostly it makes me think of Nelson Mandela, someone Esther Ann Hicks probably knows nothing about. I don't think Long Walk to Freedom is on the approved reading list for girls like her. It certainly wasn't on mine.
She continues, I'll give you a series of exclusives, but I'm going to need something from you in exchange.
What do you need? Essie shakes her head.
Not here. Not now. We'll discuss it when I call.
Exclusives covering what?
Can't you guess? She asks.
This time, her smile contains none of the sugary sweetness she used when the cameras were rolling.
I'm getting married. You'll get an exclusive on the big day.
Shit, I say, rubbing my eyes. Did that really just happen? I am driving too fast, I know, but I need to get out of this piggly town and back to the city before I start to melt. I floor it, and my hybrid rewards me with a wholly unsatisfying surge in speed. We are almost to the highway. On our left is the New Light megachurch, where Essie's father tends to his mayonnaise-colored flock. It is both gaudy and industrial at the same time, a combination that makes the building particularly unattractive from the outside. Inside must be even worse. Since then, he would be surrounded by the congregation, a group of people for whom smiling while passing judgment has become a sport. Or so I assume. I've never been to a service there, and I hope I never have to attend one. Steering clear of overpowering religious leaders is part of the spiritual cleanse I've been undergoing to make up for my first 18 years. One more turn and we are on the highway, though it looks identical to the country road we just left behind. To both the right and the left of us are cornfields, and the road runs straight and flat for another 100 miles. I can't believe it either, but is that any reason to try to break the sound barrier in a Prius? Spoiler, it's never gonna happen, says Margot. She is holding onto the center console so tightly that her knuckles are starting to turn white. I ease off on the gas a little, and Margot relaxes. She asks, when did little goody two-shoes have time to fall in love? The teenage puppy love thing I'm not particularly interested in, per se. Sure, it helps my case to break a story, even one as devoid of journalistic interest as this one. Sid is always saying, what did he hire me for if I'm not the same firebrand that I used to be when I was 14? As if anyone really wants to hear that it's all been downhill since 8th grade. What hooked me was the look in Essie's eyes. The promise that there is more behind those blue irises than the mindless sheep she has always appeared to be. An exclusive, Margot is saying. A whole series of interviews leading up to the wedding. The wedding hasn't been confirmed, I say. And now I'm starting to have doubts that any of this is real. There's no way her parents would let her get engaged at 17, let alone married. You don't know that, Margot says, and I can hear the hope in her voice. If I know anything about her at all, it is that she is already spending the money in her head. Margot has been known to burn through her paycheck with little regard for the need to pay bills or buy groceries, which is a large part of why her wife handles their finances these days. What about that other TV family, the one with all the kids? They married them off pretty young. And then they got canceled, I remind her. If there's one thing the Hicks family knows how to do, it's go the distance. Conservative enough to appeal to the Bible Belt, but not so backward as to alienate the East Coast viewers. They found the sweet spot, I'll give them that. No, Essie will do whatever save the children crap she was peddling, and then she'll get her ass into college. I guarantee it. Especially since they didn't get to air the college episodes they had planned for Elizabeth when she dropped off the face of the earth. Maybe they'll let you do a series of interviews anyway, Margot, ever the optimist, tells me. The more airtime you get, the better. Tell me something I don't know. I sigh. This is the sort of rhetorical statement that Margot has a tendency to take seriously. So she says, the state with the lowest highest point is Florida, where Britain Hill rises to only 345 feet above sea level. Thank you, I tell her, deadpanning. I'm sure that information will be very useful at parties. We get back to the city just after 11. I drop Margot off and then drive the 7 blocks to my apartment. Mr. Danziger has left his Weber cooling in my spot again, and I have to get out of my car and drag it back onto the patio before I can park. I shoot his door a withering look as I climb past his landing to the 3rd floor. Mike is asleep on the couch, presumably overcome by the act of waiting up for me. I can't really blame him. There's a constitutional law book open on his chest. If I'd been reading that, I'd probably be asleep as well. I bypass the living room and head straight to the kitchen and open an IPA. I take a sip as I sink into a chair across from Mike and remember the summer we found this chair on the side of the road and he insisted that we carry it home even though home was 14 blocks away. This was before we had a car. When it still felt strange that there was a we. Back then, we weren't living together, not really. I was technically still living in Barbara Lawrence's spare room as far as my parents were concerned. Though, even then, Mike's apartment was where I was spending most of my nights. Small town girl in the big city. They almost didn't let me come. None of the Bells had ever moved away. I practically had to bribe my parents to let me leave home for college, and then, after graduation, I had to get a lawyer to gain access to the account where the money from my book had been deposited. It could have gotten uglier than it did, I suppose. At least my parents were still speaking to me after that. Now, not so much. It was the living in sin that finally broke them. Not what had happened, of course, but when it hit the papers. I was surprised, actually, by the vitriol, which I realize is entirely hypocritical. After all, hadn't I been one of those mudslingers in the first place? Weren't the profits from such bitterness and name-calling precisely what I would eventually use to pay my half of the rent for Mike's, for our apartment? So I shouldn't really regret the book, or the blog, or even the flaming dumpster fire of a podcast that defined my life from age 12 until about 18. But I do. I regret it every day. I am lucky to have that money, little though it is. There is some part of me that does acknowledge that. But it doesn't feel like luck. It feels like a pittance given in exchange for my near-perpetual humiliation. I deserve it, though. I deserve everything I get. For Whom the Bell Tolls made a surprise appearance on a few bestseller lists. That it was written by a 14-year-old gun-toting, gay-bashing hick named Liberty Bell pretty much summed up the entirety of its appeal. The number of people who bought copies because they were legitimately interested in my thoughts was most likely outweighed by those who did not read it at all. Some probably bought the book in error, thinking they were ordering the famous novel. But others bought it to send me a message that the people I hated so much for being different were capable of kindness in the face of hatred, of turning the other cheek. Once it was publicized that the profits were being placed in a trust to which I would only gain access when I turned 21, there was a movement among liberals to order copies online to be sent to an organization that would shred them. Volunteers used the strips of paper to make a giant papier-mâché replica of the actual Liberty Bell, the one in Philadelphia. Even at the time, I had to admit that it was pretty well done. Then, the giant, painstakingly assembled paper bell was placed front and center at a ceremony, welcoming a busload of Sudanese refugees. The headlines boasted something about literally creating love from hate. In the picture accompanying the story in the Gazette, the men and women making the thing wore T-shirts that said, "Free Libby," or sometimes, "Liberty for the Bell." They had financed my escape long before I realized that an escape was something I needed. The book, the blog, all of it was why I was given the job I have. But it is also why it has been impossible for me to find another. No one wants to be associated with the sort of person I used to be. No one, that is, except for Sid, my boss, and the asshole that he works for. That kind of crap is what they've built their fortunes on. They churn it out day after day, year after year, and their faithful viewers don't know any better than to lap it up, chunks and all. Mike was also sleeping the first time I saw him, I remember. His hair was longer then, but really his face looked no different than it does now. Jaw slack and mouth slightly open, a small pool of spit forming at the corner of his lip. He looked like buzzard bait, dozing there like that. There was someone sitting across the table from him that day in the library, another freshman, who had torn up little bits of paper and rolled them around between his fingertips until they were pressed into hard, round balls. I recognized the kid from my European literature class, his pimply face scrunched up in a look of concentration as he lobbed his miniature grenades at Mike, trying to land one of those balls right in the corner of Mike's mouth. When one of them hit Mike square between the eyes, he lifted a hand as if waving away a gnat, but he didn't wake up. The kid, who I remember talked incessantly all semester about how James Joyce was his personal hero, hesitated, waiting until he was sure Mike was still truly and deeply sleeping, and then started throwing the paper balls again. The floor was littered with them when I walked out of the library several hours later, but by that time, Mike was gone. We didn't formally meet until that spring. He stopped by my dorm room, looking for my roommate, and when I told him she was in the shower, he said that he would wait. I stood, blocking the doorway, not sure what was expected, then stepped back to let him in. He flopped gracelessly onto Lara's bed and leaned against the wall. I had never been alone with a boy before, and I had the sudden urge to run. Looking longingly at the door, willing Lara to return, I moved back to my desk and tried to continue working on my blog.
"Writing something?"
he asked. My back was to him, and then suddenly he was at my shoulder. I could feel his hand on the back of my chair. I sat up straighter and closed my laptop, but not before he saw. I felt him back away across the room.
"You're her,"
he said in disbelief.
"You're Liberty Bell.
Lara never told me." "Why would she?" I challenged, ready for a fight. "There's nothing to tell." He was sitting on Lara's bed again, but this time with his feet on the edge of the shaggy pink rug she'd put down on the floor beside it. He was still skinny then, all elbows and knees, a collection of sharp edges. He folded himself forward and leaned his arms on his legs as if pressed down from above.
"I grew up hearing about that day,"
he breathed. I said nothing, and in the time it took for his words to register, Lara burst into the room, wet hair streaming, wrapped in a yellow robe. Mike stood and Lara hugged him, even though she was naked underneath the thin layer of cotton. He pulled a pair of tickets to some concert from his back pocket and handed them to her, and she hugged him again and said thanks. And then all at once, he was gone.
"You feeling okay, Libs?" she asked, and dove into the closet in search of a perfect pair of shoes to match the dress she wanted to wear that night.
"Fine," I said. "I just need a break. I think I'll go for a run." I pulled on a pair of sneakers and burst out of the building and into the cold air, my heart still racing because I knew exactly which day Mike was talking about. I ran toward the lake, but before I even got to the edge of campus, I had to hightail it to a trash bin to throw up. I stood there, retching, long after my stomach was finally empty, hands like a vise on the painted black metal rim of the can. I was shaking. Mike stirs on the couch, and I say, "Hey." Then, "Thanks for waiting up." He rubs his eyes and blinks at me.
"You know I need my beauty sleep,"
he says. I rock forward out of my chair and move a pillow so that I can slide next to him, nestling my head on his chest. I can feel his heartbeat, deep and slow like the ticking of some ancient clock. When I am settled, he curls one hand onto my head and asks,
"How was it?"
"Didn't you watch?"
"Of course, but how did it feel to be in the same room with her? Esther Hicks in the flesh."
"She was very professional," I say, not sure where to start or how much I really want to tell.
"She's done this before."
I know that Mike does not mean it unkindly, but for some reason I feel it as a slight, that he clearly thinks of Essie as having more experience on camera than I, even though I realize that of course she does. It's been her entire life. I, on the other hand, nearly a year out of journalism school, am continually frustrated that I have so little to show for it. Puff pieces, mostly. This one was no less puffy, but since Essie hasn't been seen on camera in a while, there's a chance that it will get picked up by the national media and aired again. Even if there are no follow-up meetings, today's interview still ranks as the pinnacle of my adult career to date. Pathetic. Did she say why she asked for you specifically?
Mike wants to know. I shake my head. I didn't get a chance to ask. Maybe next time.
I have to buy Margot a new phone tomorrow, I remind myself. Maybe I can expense it.
Next time?
Mike asks. She's offered me more interviews, I say slowly.
Isn't that a good thing?
I shrug. I didn't really get the sense that she had run it by her people. It may come to nothing.
Well, even so, I think you did great today.
Really?
Sure,
he says.
I hardly recognized you with all that makeup on. You almost looked pretty.
I punch him in the stomach, and he throws his hands up in surrender. Then he lifts my head so he can kiss me, and I let him for a little while, taking comfort in how solid he feels. How familiar. Eventually, I pull my head back and say, I feel sorry for her. Mike sits back and laughs sardonically.
Sure, poor little rich girl with her mansion and her private jet to fly her down to that big place they have in the Caribbean. She's really suffering.
None of that money is hers, I remind him.
But I'm sure it will be someday. Money like that can buy anything. That idiot brother of hers is leading in the polls and he hasn't even officially declared. What qualifies him for the house? He was practically at the bottom of his class in law school.
He did go to Yale, I say, nudging him playfully with my head.
And how do you think he got in there in the first place?
Yale had turned Mike down, so I know it's best to drop it. I lean against the arm of the couch and stretch my legs out straight onto Mike's lap and say, she's not like that, though.
You think you can tell what she's really like by how she acts when she's on camera?
No, but there was a moment after. I stop, consider whether to tell Mike about the wedding, and decide against it. Instead, I say, we were alone for a few minutes after the interview. She just seemed different then. It reminded me that she's a real person, not just that little girl we've all been watching on TV.
That doesn't mean she deserves your pity.
Why not? Isn't she just as much a product of her environment as I was of mine? Isn't that why you forgave me for all the things I did? Mike sits up straighter at this and looks right at me.
First of all, I never pitied you. Let's be clear about that. Second of all, I had nothing to forgive you for. You didn't do anything to me. Besides, you were just a kid.
Isn't that exactly what she is, too?
Esther Hicks is not a child,
Mike says then.
She's a virus. Her entire family is. They've infected the country with a special brand of intolerance that masquerades as a religion.
She's done nothing that I haven't done, I say softly. She's just had more success.
You were different. You couldn't help it.
Don't you dare think that what happened to Justice is an excuse, I tell him, and my voice is louder than I mean it to be.
As if she somehow lets me off the hook. Well, you're trying to do what's right now. That's what matters.
Maybe Essie is trying too. I want Mike to back down, But his voice is bitter when he says,
"By giving you more interviews? Her generosity is overwhelming."
"She's just a kid," I try again. "She's grown up inside a bubble, and she just seemed so small, so vulnerable. She has no idea at all how the real world works."
Esther. For the first time in my life, Mother is doing what I want and not the other way around. She doesn't know this, of course, and her not knowing is the only hope I have that this might work. It's only when the Richardses have left the house late on Thursday afternoon that I am sure my plan has actually been set in motion. Until then, I was limited to watching Mother's face for some sign of confirmation. But of course, the last thing I could do was ask. When Mr. and Mrs. Richards pile into their ancient station wagon, Mother comes into the den where I am reading. I don't look up right away. It wouldn't do to look too eager. I wait for her to clear her throat, and only then do I turn Wuthering Heights over in my lap. "Esther Ann," Mother says, and I know that she is hooked. She only uses my middle name when she is about to tell me something that she knows might cause a fight. "I've been thinking a lot about your situation." She says this as if my situation, as she put it, has nothing to do with her, at least not directly, as if it is not in any way her fault. Mother sighs and looks vacantly toward the window. I can tell that she is not really looking out at the fragile splendor of the cherry tree, which is in full blossom, but is instead considering whether enough time has passed for her to replace the drapes. It takes a while before she continues, but I wait as patiently as I can, tracing a finger over the embossed B of Bronte until she turns her face back to look at me. "I've considered all the options, and I really believe that the best course of action is for you to get married, quickly, before you're too far along." I keep my face still, but force my eyes to widen, provide just the right measure of shock. "If that's what you think is best," I say as reluctantly as I can. "I do," Mother says, and her voice carries just an edge of brusqueness. It makes me want to stab her through the eyes. This is the life of a child, she is deciding. The life of two children, actually, since technically I am still one myself. I hate her for the calculation in her eyes when she looks at me, as if I were a rat she is training to run through a maze. "Did you tell?" I ask. "Darling," she says too sweetly, "I've told no one. I promised that I wouldn't, and I shan't. Not Daddy, not anyone. It is our secret. We will get through this thing together." For some reason, it makes me feel better to hear the lie, as if it makes everything entirely justified. "Who will I marry?" I ask in a voice that I hope conveys just the right degree of shyness. Mother sighs again and stands. It seems this heart-to-heart is already over. "Soon, dearest. It's almost decided." The next day after school, there is a baseball game, and I ask Mother if I can stay to watch. Sporting events are still cleared for filming. It's just inside the school that's banned. Well, not entirely, but it requires special clearance. When I first started at Woodside, the crew followed me everywhere I went, even into some of my classes. But then Veronica Richter, who was a year ahead of me, put an end to that, complained that it was a violation of her right to privacy, and created an environment hostile to learning. She wasn't the only one who objected, but she was the first. Now they can film me at the bus stop or walking to school, but not inside the bus or the school building itself. That is, except during specially staged events like the school concert and the discussion group in my fake English class, the one where we're reading Wuthering Heights. It made Veronica pretty unpopular for the second half of her sophomore year, but she didn't seem to notice, or else she just didn't care. She has this ability to float above it all, which made it kind of surprising that she was bothered so much by the cameras. I like to think she was just doing me a favor after finding me locked in the girls' bathroom one morning before U.S. history, when I was trying to avoid my crew. She was giving me the sort of space I could never have gotten on my own, even if I had been brave enough to ask. If that really was the reason she lodged the complaint with the principal, then it was one of the nicest things anyone has ever done for me. Which is weird because Veronica Richter is not even my friend. Mother looks surprised, but she agrees. It's not often that I'm willing to go to games of any sort, so it's possible that she just wants the footage and doesn't even know that Rourke Richards is the captain of the baseball team. I need to talk to him before this goes any further, to warn him or just try to explain. But the truth is, I have no idea what I intend to say. The day drags on. I see Rourke between first and second period and then again just after lunch. He moves easily through the halls. People move aside to let him pass, a fact of which he seems entirely unaware. His dark eyes are always elsewhere, his smooth jaw set. Both times I see him, I try to catch his eye, but he is always in motion and he never looks my way. Why would he? We've never even really met. I've seen him at church, of course, but his family tends to slip in and then out again. They don't stay for the handshaking and coffee cake crumbling torture that starts after the service ends. "God is love," proclaims the bright felted banner on one wall of the refectory. My Sunday school class made it when I was 11. The lopsided V in love is entirely my fault. Beneath the words are two outstretched felt hands, palms held toward the gathered, in a way that gives the impression that they are pushing or shooing instead of welcoming in. I understand why the Richards family might choose to avoid coffee hour. It's all gossip and backstabbing as far as I'm concerned. So Rourke and I have never talked at church, and we've certainly never talked at school. It's not a very promising relationship, especially when I consider that spring break is just around the corner, and that means I need Rourke to propose by the end of next week, Sunday at the latest. It is the first really warm day of the month, and although I've worn a sweater, I take it off sometime in the fifth inning. The sun beats down on my back and arms as I sit squeezed between Lily and Tabitha Riker on the bleachers. I made sure to chat with a sufficient number of people before the game, so Lincoln, who is my cameraman today, could get enough shots of me moving through the crowd while the light still holds. I waved to Reggie White, hoping that he'd come over since footage of me talking to an African-American would really get Mother's knickers in a twist. I know she'd never allow them to use it. But imagining her trying to explain to the editors why the footage needs to be cut without saying the word black made it worth a try. Reggie ignored me. I can't blame him. I would ignore me too if I were him. Instead, I talked with Bobby Schaefer, who was a year behind me, but tall enough to look good in the shot. I leaned against the chain-link fence that separates the crowd from the dugout and smiled, allowing my eyes to drift over to Rourke while Bobby talked, my gaze shifting in a way that I knew would be obvious once the footage is reviewed. I am nothing if not helpful. Now, while I sit with Lily and Tabitha, Lincoln gets some shots of the game itself, including one good one where Rourke hits the ball far into the outfield and then almost makes it home before retreating to third base. After this, Lincoln waves and indicates that he and his sidekick are going to pack up and leave. I wave back and watch them trudge off to their van and then, after stowing their equipment, finally drive away. By the time the game is over, I really need to pee. But I know that if I run over to the bathrooms, Rourke will probably be gone when I get back. I say goodbye to Tabitha and shoot a look at Lily, who is getting kissed by Mason Clinch. Weaving through the crowd, I head straight for Rourke, not caring what this will look like to anyone who is bothering to watch. He is bent over and rifling through his bag when I reach him. "Rourke," I say, "I'm Esther Hicks. I don't think we've ever been formally introduced." He stands up and I extend my hand, which he eyes suspiciously but does not take. I drop the hand self-consciously to my side and pick at the fabric of my skirt.
"What do you want?"
he asks. The bluntness of the question surprises me, and I realize that I still have no earthly clue what is the right thing to say. For all that I know about Rourke, I don't actually know him. Not really. For instance, I had assumed that he would probably dislike me, but the tone of his voice tells me that it runs deeper than that. In the end, this is probably a good thing. It means that we are on the same side. But it also means that it's going to be harder than I thought to make him realize this, that it might take some time. And time is something I just don't have. I decide to try. Lily says she heard that you're probably going to be valedictorian. His expression doesn't change, so I say, Lily Gaines? I thought you knew her. The way Lily tells it, she and Rourke practically did it standing up on the front steps of her house, and then he never called her. Rourke still doesn't say anything, so I continue on with, I'm actually graduating this year myself. I've been taking some extra classes. He raises his eyebrows, and then he says,
So you're saying you might be valedictorian instead?
I shake my head and take a step back. This isn't going at all the way I'd planned. No, I'm not eligible, and even if I were, I'm sure you'd still get it. Have you decided where you want to go to college?
I haven't heard back from all the places I applied, but I'll probably end up at State.
I tilt my head and pretend to be confused. Really? I always pegged you for the Ivy League, or at least someplace in Chicago. Rourke throws his duffel over his shoulder and says,
You get what you get, and you don't get upset.
It's a throwaway comment, the sort of phrase a kindergartner would use, but it is also a way in. Why don't you? I say.
What?
He asks me, surprised. Get upset, I say, and then, You should get upset when things aren't fair. You should do something to fix them.
Is that right? And just what is it that you're doing to fight all the injustice in the world?
I think how best to answer, but since Blake Preston is walking toward us, I take another step back and simply say, You'll see. I give a half smile and turn. I can feel Rourke's eyes following me as I walk away. Not perfect, I think, but it will have to do. I walk home quickly, stopping in the bathroom off the front hall as soon as I walk in the door. Then I head upstairs to change. My foot is on the second step when I hear the voices coming from the production office. It is unusual for anyone to be in there at this time unless there is an evening taping. Candy should have gone home for the day. Even Gretchen, who makes a habit of staying late to showcase her work ethic, usually takes off in time to eat dinner with her disabled brother. I retrace my path and tiptoe to the laundry room, climb onto the dryer, and kneel with my ear toward the vent. I hear Mother's voice, then Suzanne and Leroy Richards each say something in return. Mother is moving even faster than I could have hoped.
I just wanted to follow up on the lovely chat we had yesterday, Mother is saying. I was so sorry to hear about your troubles with the bank and with the store. We have always been proud patrons of Richards and Sons Sporting Goods. In fact, I think that's where Jethro and I bought all the boys their very first hunting rifles.
It was, ma'am, Leroy Richards says.
And I was so very impressed to hear about Rourke getting into Columbia, Mother continues. It would be a shame to put such an opportunity to waste.
There's nothing wrong with going to State,
Mr. Richards says sharply.
Oh, I agree, of course. Our own Caleb went to State before continuing on to Yale. It can be quite a stepping stone toward bigger and brighter things. But you said yourselves that the store is in danger. If it goes under, then even the tuition at State will feel like $1 million, when those are dollars you just don't have.
We'll make do,
Leroy tells her, and I can hear the anger in his voice, anger that is entirely justified under the circumstances. But it is not only anger. He sounds offended and dangerously close to walking out of the room.
I know you will, Mother says in her most soothing tone. But you shouldn't have to. Shouldn't have to just make do, that is. Fine, Christian folks like yourselves. You should be able to put your brilliant boy through school and not give it a second thought. A boy like that, captain of the baseball team, future valedictorian from what I hear. The hardest decision you all should be having to make is just which of the many fine schools he's been accepted to is the most deserving of him. Not the other way around. You shouldn't be waiting on the mercy of some financial aid officer to decide your only child's fate.
Mother knows far more about Rourke Richards than I have given her credit for. I wonder if her spies have uncovered all of the Richards family secrets. But clearly they have not, or else she would not be bargaining for Rourke to stand with me before the altar. What else can we do? Mrs. Richards is asking, and I hear the hopelessness in her voice, the utter lack of imagination.
Well, now that you ask, I do have an idea. I'm sure it will seem rather extreme, shocking, even.
Mother pauses, and I can practically see Suzanne Richards leaning forward against the table, see her fingers fluttering over the wooden surface as she longs to take my mother's hand. She is seeking salvation, with my mother playing the role of savior, a role Mother is all too willing to embrace.
Go on,
Mrs. Richards says breathily.
I don't know if you're aware of how seriously our ratings are flagging. It's a travesty, actually, with all the good works that Maddie and Daniel are doing overseas right now. I so wish we were reaching more people with their message of hope.
What on earth has that got to do with Rourke in college?
Mr. Richards asks. He is still annoyed, but the edge in his voice is gone. She has him interested. Mother says,
We need something to keep the viewers invested, especially the young people, because we all know that they are the ones most in danger of straying, most in need of the example that we strive to demonstrate. Essie has plans to graduate early and spend next year in Manhattan. She's already corresponded with some principals as well as with the chancellor of the New York City schools. She wants to teach poor children to read, bless her heart. Perhaps you saw her on television yesterday. No? Well, I know you don't have daughters, but I'm sure you can appreciate that there is no way I can allow her to go to a place like that unchaperoned.
Mother is rewarded with a, goodness me, of course not, from Mrs. Richards.
But we've also been told by our production team and marketing researchers that it's important to viewers that Essie be able to find her own way in this world. They are most engaged with her when she is acting on her own, exploring.
Here Mother sighs, and I wonder if Suzanne Richards has now overcome her shyness and reached out to take my mother's hand. Mother says,
It has been suggested that if Essie were married, if she had a trustworthy young man looking after her, then maybe we would feel more comfortable letting her go. Now, at first, I said, no, of course, she's too young. It was out of the question. But the more I thought about it, the more sense it made. Who better to look after her than a husband? Who better for her to share this new adventure with?
I didn't even know that Essie had been dating, Suzanne Richards says.
She hasn't, Mother tells her. But why should a little thing like that stand in our way?
Our way?
Mr. Richards asks.
Our way, my mother says again. I would very much like for your son to marry my daughter. It's not romantic, I know, but I'm certain that they would grow to love each other. In the meantime, your family would be generously compensated for what I realize is an incredibly unorthodox proposition. I intend nothing, Tawdry, I assure you. They could live as friends if they so desire. I'm certainly not in the habit of pimping out my youngest child.
I close my eyes,
The most disgusting thing about this is that Mother believes what she has just said.
Now, let me just get this straight, says Mr. Richards. You want us to tell Rourke that he should marry a girl who is practically a stranger just so you can help your ratings and he can babysit her in New York?
And so he'd get to go to New York as well, don't forget. We'd pay for Columbia. That would be written into the agreement. And we'd pay off what you owe on the store and on your house. Then, if the young people remain married for at least 5 years, enough to get Essie safely through college after taking next year off, both you and they would be given an additional incentive, with another bonus given for every 5 years they remain together after that. There is a scraping of chairs, and I sense that my mother has stood, not Suzanne or Leroy Richards, who are both no doubt still somewhat dumbfounded. It's a lot to take in, and I've kept you too long as it is. I don't expect an answer now. Go home and think it over. Do you have a lawyer? Excellent! We'll meet again soon, and if your answer is yes, we'll let the suits hammer out the details the next time we talk. Let me show you out. I consider hiding in the laundry room until they've gone, but decide that seeing them in person can only help my cause. Make this all seem real and less like some fantasy cooked up by an overbearing parent. I slip into the hall and away from the production office so that it will look as if I am just coming down the stairs. When I hear the door open, I turn and skip back down the last few steps and then come up short, as if I'm startled. Mrs. Richards! Mr. Richards, what are... I stop there as if remembering my manners and instead say, It's a pleasure to see you. Rourke hit quite a triple in the game today. I hope you'll tell him hello for me. I smile and do my best to look like daughter-in-law material, the sort of girl you dream your son might willingly bring home someday instead of the knocked-up used goods that I know I am. Suzanne's eyes dart toward Mother and then back to me. Your mother has just been telling us about a plan of hers. I can't let her say any more than that, or else I'll be forced to either storm up the stairs and protest like a normal teenager, or come out directly in support of arranged marriages. Neither seems like a good idea at this juncture, not when what the Richardses really need is some time to sit with the idea, time to think about the money. Once they've done that, I very much suspect they'll stop caring what I think, or how strange all of this must seem. Instead, I giggle, a little too maniacally, so I stop abruptly and then say, Oh, Mother's always making plans. She's where I get it from, I guess. Did she tell you I might get to go to New York City next year? I've only just begun my research, but apparently the high school graduation rate there is less than 70%. Can you imagine? And since it's been established that early childhood literacy greatly impacts school performance well into adulthood, isn't it obvious that someone has to step up and teach these children to read? Inspire them to dream of a better life for themselves and for their families? Each and every one of those children should have an opportunity to change this country for the better. They only need someone to help them take those first steps and learn the value of hard work and perseverance. I am talking too fast. And moreover, what I am saying is complete and utter nonsense. Mother looks aghast, but Suzanne Richards, so sweet, so in need of hope, nods at me with tears in her eyes. Bless you, child, she tells me. And then she and Mr. Richards leave. When they are gone, Mother leans back against the door and faces me. Well, she tells me, that just might have worked. I think we may find you a husband in time after all. That night I sit on my bed and retrieve the phone I practically stole from Liberty Bell's camera woman from where I have hidden it beneath my mattress. I turn it on, and while I wait for it to power up, I press it between my hands to study them. It is still too soon for me to promise anything, I know, but I can't wait any longer. I scroll through Margot's recent calls, and there she is, under Libby B. I hear a door close down the hall as my parents shut themselves into their room. The house is still. Growing up, it had never really been quiet, not like this. Lissa would be yelling at Caleb to turn down his music or at Jacob to stop bouncing his ball against the wall between their rooms. Mother would say, "Boys will be boys, Elizabeth. Just ignore it." She was always Elizabeth to the others. She was Lissa, just with me. The boys were always allowed to be boys. That was a precedent that was set early on, when even Daniel and Maddie were still around most of the time. They would come and go from college, but they were usually home on weekends to drop off a hamper filled with dirty laundry, or to eat an entire refrigerator full of food. They had the run of the house. They were kings of the castle. They were not ever once told no. It was different for Lissa and me. We were made to do the chores that our brothers skipped out on, no matter what their reason. We picked up the slack. We covered. We bent ourselves to their wills. The quiet is unsettling, even though Lissa has been gone for almost 4 years. It still sounds alien, that vacuum where there should be something. What? I don't know. Just something. But instead there isn't anything at all. I press the call button and Liberty Bell picks up on the second ring. I do not even give her time to say hello before I speak, knowing that when I do, things will be set in motion that I will have no power to stop even if I wanted to. The same thing happened when I went to the library. Even when I was standing there, I almost walked away. My voice is barely more than a whisper, and I cannot say all I need to say here, in my room, with my parents so nearby. But still, I am afraid that I will lose my nerve if I don't speak right away. I hear a buzzing of traffic and loud voices when the line connects, and I ask for the one thing that might end the quiet, fill the emptiness I feel inside. I need you to find my sister, please.
Liberty. I am half a block from my apartment when she calls. I weave through the Friday night crowds outside O'Leary's pub and try to step away from them and into the street, but someone is throwing up near the curb. Mama would say he's airing the paunch and shake her head with disapproval. Once, when Lee Sherman puked in front of the post office, she actually made the sign of the cross in the air and turned and walked in the opposite direction. Mama never did care for excess, especially when it came to a man who didn't know how to hold his liquor. As I break out of the throng, I begin to jog. I can barely hear Essie over the voices behind me, and the fact that some driver chooses that exact moment to lay on his horn only makes it worse. I let myself into the small square entryway of our building and fumble with my keys, the phone cupped between my ear and my shoulder. "Don't hang up," I tell her, as the rest of my belongings clatter onto the floor. "Balls!" I exclaim, then quickly apologize as I pick up my things and eventually get my fingers on the correct key. It sticks in the lock at first, of course, because our landlord doesn't know the difference between a screwdriver and his own dick, and also because he's counting on my getting annoyed and finally fixing the deadbolt myself. I lean my weight back while holding the handle to pull the door tight, and only then can I get the key to turn. Inside, I sit on the stairs and extract a notebook from my bag rather than tackling the two flights up to my apartment. "Sorry about that. I was just outside. I didn't hear you. What was it you said?" The voice that comes through the phone is small, and I am reminded once again of just how young Essie is. It is what I was trying to explain to Mike when I got home last night, though I didn't exactly do a bang-up job of it. "My sister," she says. "I need you to find her." "Elizabeth? She's still at Northwestern, isn't she? She's supposed to graduate in May." "That's what the papers say," Essie replies. "But it's not true?" I hear a sigh. "It may be true. I don't know. I haven't spoken to her since she left." "When was that?"
When she left for school, we haven't spoken since she left for college her freshman year.
My pencil stops then, and I hold it just above the notepad that is open on my knees. I am confused.